for the end of policing. Stay tuned.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted.
This is Cat Meow.
And this is Becky.
And we want to hang out with you.
The Development Committee will meet the third Wednesday of every month at 7 p.m.
We're traffic informed and
food motivated.
And we're seeking like-minded individuals who want to use their rad fundraising skills and talents to
support the station. Join us.
There's something healing about being able to go back into African histories and see what we are capable of.
Afrofuturism is a genre movement rooting elements of science fiction and fantasy in traditions from Africa and the diaspora, and its popularity as a form of resistance is on the rise. But Afrofuturist concepts have been prevalent in music and literature since the 1950s. You've got jazz musician Sun Ra and authors Samuel R. Delaney and Octavia Butler.
The surrealists believed that you have to first change your dreams in order to change the world. And I feel that that's what speculative fiction, any kind of speculative fiction, people writing, black comics, they're imagining a better world. They're dreaming a better world, a different world. And I realized that's what I wanted to spend my life doing.
On this episode, authors Nalo Hopkinson, Nettie Okorafor, and Jewel Gomez sit down with John Jennings at the San Francisco Public Library as part of the 2016 Black Comics Festival. They discuss the role of Afrofuturist thought in the modern context and the importance of allowing ourselves to imagine. I'm your guest host, Charlotte Landis, and you're listening to Making Contact.
When I sit down to write, I don't think I'm an Afrofuturist writer, I'm going to write an Afrofuturist whatever.
Nalo Hopkinson.
I'll happily claim the adjective. It happened after I started writing.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. It is a label that people use to try and pull together a pattern that they're seeing. And in so much as what it is, it's useful. Mm-hmm. But it is also not as simple as I'm just a writer. Of course, I'm not just a writer. I am everything that I am. But the Afrofuturism part is, it's got to be somewhere else when I write, or it will stop me. I'm writing science fiction fantasy, so there's a lot of research that goes into it, and a lot of, not just research, but theorizing, because of course the history books leave stuff out. So you have to imagine yourself into those places. I'm researching the future, I'm researching the past, I'm researching black history, Caribbean history, white history. I barely stayed awake through a history class when I was in school. And now, if you look at my shelves, that stuff is all over the place. And I discover the more I go into it, the more I realize that human beings are human beings. You can reach back into the very beginning of time when human beings are human beings, and we aren't that different. And there's something healing about being able to go back into African histories and African cultures and African ways of life and see that what we are capable of, which, you know, but to see it proven over and over and over and over again as the centuries go by and the centuries go forward.
I definitely look into my past.
Nettie Okorafor.
I am what I consider Niger-American, which means Niger is slang for Nigerian, and I'm American. So Nigerian-American. I was born and raised in this country, but from a young age, my parents were taking me back to, my siblings and I, back to Nigeria to reconnect with our heritage, reconnect with our family. Most of our family is there. And so, and then also just being Nigerian American in the house, within that culture, within the Igbo culture, those old traditions and ways have seeped into who I am as well. So those all manifest themselves. My Nigerian Americanness definitely manifests itself in my work. I deal a lot with the traditional spiritualities, especially of the Igbo people, but of other parts of the continent as well. One example are masquerades. Masquerades show up in my works a lot. Masquerades are found in many different African cultures, but I have like a lot of what I write about comes from personal experience. So my personal experience with masquerades. Masquerades are like they're manifestations of the dead and the ancestors and spirits. And they are many different types. Some can look very monstrous, like, you know, just raffia and cloth that can look like monsters. And those are the ones that I've been obsessed with. And so when I was a kid, whenever we'd go back to Nigeria, the masquerades would come out around Christmas time, that's a whole other issue. You come out around Christmas time, and because my sisters and I were American Nigerians, they would harass us the most. So, and they would literally chase us down the street. Okay, they would chase us. They had like a whip, and they would whip people, and they would chase us down the street with the whip. And luckily, we were fast, so we weren't caught too many times. So when I think back, I'm like, okay. And a lot of times we would outrun them. And so when I think back, I'm like, oh, I was outrunning the spirits. Mm-hmm. And so in my own stories, you see the masquerade show up a lot in my stories, and they show up in a way where they show up in the way that I imagine them, because I've seen the really big, terrifying ones at weddings, and all the women just run to the other side of the room. It's just, it's really quite epic. And in my stories, because I'm writing speculative fiction, I can imagine those masquerades the way I see them, which is as they're not people or men in particular dressed up in these elaborate costumes who then take on the ancestor or the spirit. They are that creature. Mm. And so in my stories, I can do that. I can show them that way. And I have a lot of fun with it. So I do look in the past.
I would love to hear if people have specifics about what prompted them to write their first.
Jewel Gomez.
Mine was based on a very specific incident that happened to me in the mid-80s. Does anybody here remember telephone booths? Okay. I was in a telephone booth at the corner of my street. I guess my phone wasn't working, or I had rebelled and not paid the bill. But so I was in the phone booth, and these two guys walked by me and went into their whole thing. Oh, baby, let me suck your blah, 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 blah. And I want to do this to you. And oh, you're looking so good, as if that would interest me, their opinion. And I was talking to my friend, Marianne, and she said, "What's going on?" I said, "Hold on a second." I turned and looked at them, and I said, "Please go away." And then I turned back to Marianne. Well, of course, they didn't go away. They just went on and on. I said, "Hold on." I turned around. I said, "Motherfucker, I will kill you if you don't get a fuck with me." And one of the guys said, "This is crazy." And the other guy was just like, kept on going. I said, "Yes, I am crazy, and I will kill you." And used a lot of that language that my grandmother had asked me not to use. And the one guy dragged the other guy away. Wow. And this was on West End Avenue and 93rd Street in Manhattan. My adrenaline had gone through my body like crazy. I was so happy there was nothing at hand for me to pick up.
Right.
Because they keep West End Avenue kind of clean. My friend, Marianne, I heard her screaming, "Jewel, Jewel, Jewel," because she thought I was killing someone. And so I said, "Marianne, I can't talk. I have to go home. I can't talk." So I went home, and I caught my breath, and I sat down, and I wrote the first Gilda story. Mm. Yeah. And it was a woman walking in on the street, and a guy does that to her, and of course she kills him.
I'm so going to use that when I teach the Gilda stories.
Goss is his body in the river. So I decided I better use my powers for good.
Please.
And over time, you know, evolved the vampire mythology, because that's really what I realized I was working on, so that she didn't have to kill people, and developed a whole philosophy around it. So that fit into my political, mm-hmm. social political philosophy mm-hmm. as a lesbian feminist. And I felt like, you know, the surrealists believed that you have to first change your dreams in order to change the world.
Right.
And I feel that that's what speculative fiction, any kind of speculative fiction, people writing black comics, they're imagining a better world. They're dreaming a better world, a different world. And I realized that's what I wanted to spend my life doing, as opposed to, you know, killing people on the street.
I keep going back to Walter Mosley, who you may or may not know, has written science fiction novels and short stories.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
And I'm going to paraphrase him, but he basically said, we need a better world, and in order to have a better world, in order to make it, we first need to be able to imagine it. Mm-hmm. And also Samuel R. Delaney, mentor of mine, who said, we need visions of the future, and our people need them more than most. Mm-hmm. So,
That's right.
It was true then, true now. And so there is very much a connection. And I sort of also think, the work is there. The work needs to be done. It's desperate. But we also need to be able to enjoy, to have fun, to have imagination, to have passion, because why else are we doing this? So I think we also need to give ourselves permission to enjoy. The work is there, and we will do it. So there's very much a connection between allowing ourselves to imagine, mm-hmm. allowing ourselves to think that we get to, like anybody else, have fun, mm-hmm. And using that to fuel the vision of what it is we're trying to make. Sometimes I just want to write strange stories set in strange places. My own reality will always seep into those stories. But I want to hold on to the fact that we get to do all of it.
Right. Yeah, I'm sitting here thinking about the word using these narratives for social justice, mm-hmm. and I'm very resistant to that.
Yeah.
Because I know that when I sit down and to write something, I'm not thinking that, okay, I want to make this point. You know, this is something I want to show the world about whatever. Mm-hmm. When it comes down to it, when I sit down to write, I'm not thinking about anything. I'm just letting it flow. I'm a very subconscious writer, where oftentimes I don't even have an outline. Mm-hmm. I don't even know who the character is. I'll just sit down and just start. Right. And whatever is flowing through me is what will flow through me. So the idea of using the narrative for something is foreign to me. I mean, I understand other writers, other artists who operate like that, but for me, I definitely don't. But I do know that I'm very much a political person. So those ideas and my what I want to see, the changes that I want to see, and the things that I want to do and want to see done, those are already there. Those are things that I might have conversations about when I'm not writing. But when I sit down to write, those things come through in a more indirect way. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, I deal with my books tend to be very political, and it's not that I sat down and thought, okay, I want to write this political story. It's just that they are, because I am.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say the same. I think I might be a little more conscious of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think I start out to write agitprop, but having come of age, you know, in the civil rights movement, the black arts movement, all of the work that people were doing was an expression of liberation and opening new worlds to us, the worlds of blackness. So I think I started writing in a very conscious way about blackness, the same as being a feminist. I started writing very consciously about women and how women are placed in the world. At the same time, I don't want to write a tract,
right,
you know,
of
so
course.
People will just, you know, snore. But I think though, having come of age in those particular movements make me much more conscious of it as I'm doing it. And I think that's one of the interesting things for this, going from African-Americans saying, how dare you write a vampire novel with African-Americans in it? How could you do that? How could you connect those things? To, you know, 25 years later, as my vampire novel is about to have its 25th anniversary, and a new edition, to see the community come full circle and say, oh yeah, we're going to claim this and we're going to give it its own name, Afrofuturism. You know, it's really great. And in part, I think that's because the political evolution on campuses, in communities, poorer communities who are starting to understand their economics has to be taken in their own hands.
Right.
They can't wait for the government to fix it. That racism, sexism, any of the isms really need to be in our hands. How we fight them need to be in our hands. And I think that is a sign of hope. And I think that's one of the reasons that our writing has started to spread out into these fields, into black comics, into future Afrofuturism, and other speculative fictions. I think it's a sign of hope.
You're listening to Afrofuturist Authors on Making Contact. Nalo Hopkinson is the author of 9 books, from Brown Girl in the Ring to the Nebula Award-winning Sister Mine. Nnedi Okorafor writes African-based science fiction for both children and adults, including the Nebula and Hugo Award-winning Binti series and Akata Warrior. And Jewel Gomez is a writer, activist, and the author of the Double Lambda Award-winning novel, The Gilda Stories. Her dream play, Waiting for Giovanni, is about James Baldwin. For more information about these authors, visit the Making Contact website, radioproject.org, where you'll also find past episodes. You can sign up for news about upcoming shows, like us on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter at @making_contact. You can also find us on Instagram at Making Contact Radio Project. Please rate us on iTunes. It helps other people find us. Now let's rejoin the conversation as our three authors discuss the monsters that have captured their imagination and what they hope to see in the future of Afrofuturism.
I'm sitting here trying to figure out why this monster is so central to so many of my stories. There are two. One of them is Godzilla. And this is why I'm sitting here trying to figure out, okay, because Godzilla has shown up in many of my stories in various ways. And I know that if someone were to just ask me without intellectualizing it, why do I like Godzilla, it's Godzilla's destructive nature. Godzilla comes out of the water and just destroys. There's no rhyme or reason, just comes out, destroys everything, and then goes back into the water. I love that. I don't know why. I don't know why. There's something about it. And it may have something to do with my obsession with post-apocalyptic narratives as well.
Okay.
This idea of everything being destroyed, you know, and then having to deal with that.
Mm-hmm.
It also may have to do with my anger issues. I don't know.
Get it somewhere. All right.
A lot of rage. The second monster, it's not really a monster. It's just this entity that has shown up consistently in my works now. It's in Lagoon and it's It's in Akatawich Part 2 as well. And it's this spider. It's this giant spider that is, its name is Udide, which means spider in Igbo. The first time the idea of the spider showed up in one of my stories, it was in my story called Spider the Artist, which deals with the Niger Delta, where you've got like these, it's set in the near future, where you have these, the government and the oil companies have created these robot spiders to guard the pipelines, the oil pipelines in Nigeria, and prevent people from bunkering. And these spiders, of course, they kill anyone who touches them. They just tear them to shreds so that they can guard the oil. So that's sort of another story. But this spider is not a Anansi. I know that. I'm terrified of spiders. I don't know why. It's an irrational fear. And so spiders have always shown up in my stories, but this particular large one, it lives underneath the city of Lagos, and it turns onto its back and feels the vibrations of the people. And it's a monstrous spider, and it weaves and creates stories and narrative and controls everything. It's just... Yeah, so that's my second spider. Yeah, I'll stop there.
Okay, so I want to stop and read that story like right now.
Yeah.
What? Okay.
Well, I guess my monster started out as those two guys on the street, and has evolved to any figures that prey upon people who are less, powerful.
Right.
And I think that was one of the reasons I was interested in doing vampire stories, because Dracula is such a pervasive mythology, such a pervasive character, and insidious because he's charming and he's a serial killer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you go back to the original ones, that he, seduces women and kills them. And everybody is like excited. Dracula's coming over. You know, I'm like,
is it?
So that really fascinated me, that people would find this such a romantic figure in such a predatory figure.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I remember one day I went with my mother and grandmother to see the play Dracula on Broadway. We left that and went to see the movie with Frank Langella, which was playing in Times Square
same time.
And we were in conversation about that for hours. Like, how could he be so sexy and be such a killer?
Right.
So that really set me up to work on how to redo the mythology so that I felt like a vampire could be heroic and not a predator, not a serial killer. And in this new book that I'm working on, it's about the society becoming predatory, using people who are empathic, using people who have certain kinds of skills, artistic skills, and making them work for the government, segregating them into patches so they only associate with people who are doing what they do, and... how to escape that. So the monster is those who prey on less powerful people.
It is Stagoli, it is Papa Legba, it is Ishu. It is that tall, lean man, dark man in the top hat,
yes,
who knows more about the dark in you than you do, and knows that you want it.
What I'd like to see, and what I think is going to, we're going to see more and more African writers from the continent,
that's right,
writing Afrofuturist stories. And I think that the change that I've seen, because I've had a lot of interaction with especially Nigerian writers. And what I remember from maybe about 10 years ago, there was this general attitude of what is real literature, and science fiction and fantasy and speculative fiction were not considered real literature, and what was considered real literature were like Things Fall Apart, you know, serious writing without any of that weird stuff going on in it. But I think that we'll see more more Africans directly from the continent writing this kind of literature, and I think that what they write is going to have like a different flavor as well. And what I also would like to see in terms of Afrofuturism is just more diversity in the types of writing. I'd like to see female writers, writers with disabilities, just more variety within Afrofuturist writing.
Right.
That's what I'm waiting to see, because right now it's so small. You know, and it's slowly building, and it's increasing and growing. But I'd like to see more of that, and I'd also like to see really an extremely successful Afrofuturist writer, extremely successful, as in like best-selling status, who's mediocre.
Wow!
I want to see that. Yes.
Nice.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yes.
All right.
Okay. I want to see that.
For me, the idea that genre fiction, and I usually say speculative fiction to cover everything as an umbrella term, but I think speculative fiction is really an easy way for a large population to find themselves and find their politics. Mm. Any kind of genre fiction, whether it's detective stories, whether it's cartoons, whether it's a romance, I know you find that hard to believe, but any kind of genre fiction can get away with telling a political story. And if it's a genre fiction, more different kinds of people are going to read it because they feel like, oh, this is just going to be fun. And then when they finish, they realize, oh wow, I thought about that. That was deep. And whoa. And, you know, you saw Star Trek do it with issues around race. We see all kinds of TV speculative fiction shows introduce complex ideas. And I think the more of us who write and start writing younger, the more complex ideas we will put in genre fiction, and the more of us who will read them and become increasingly conscious of our political surroundings.
I hope it gives more people permission to know that they can imagine and that they can make stories. I mean, I think the three of us were at Astro Blackness a few months ago, and there was a young woman in the audience, black woman, who also loved horror and didn't think she could write it because she kept imagining black characters until she found an ARC, an advanced reading copy of one of Octavia Butler's novels on the streetcar or whatever they do in LA. And then it was like her imagination broke open and now she's writing. And it cuts to my heart that somebody thinks that because they've never seen it, they can't do it. So that's where I would hope it's going, is that more of us have just sort of know that we can stand up and make what we imagine.
You've been listening to writers Nalo Hopkinson, Nnedi Okorafor, and Jewel Gomez. A big thank you to the San Francisco Public Library for recording. For more information on Afrofuturist literature, follow the links at our website, radioproject.org. And we want to hear from you. What's your radical dream for the future? Have your say at radioproject.org, or join the conversation on Facebook, or Twitter at @making_contact, or Instagram at @makingcontactradioproject. Thanks for music from Anatech. The Making Contact team includes Lisa Rudman, Monica Lopez, Anita Johnson, Vera Tykulsker, Salima Hamarani. And I'm Charlotte Landis. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
This week on Making Contact.
When you have an economic system that says that wealth and inequality is because some people are more qualified than others, not because of the failure of market forces, then the solution is forcing those who are on the losing end to behave themselves and accept their diminished position, kind of blaming the victim. And because if we were to admit that market forces had something to do with this rise of inequality, then we'd have to do something about those market forces.
We broadcast an episode of the Upstream podcast, a conversation with Professor of Sociology, Alex Vitali, author of the book, The End of Policing. I'm your host, RJ Lozada. Stay tuned. Alex Vitali is Professor of Sociology and coordinator of the Policing and Social Justice Project at Brooklyn College. His book, The End of Policing, is an accessible study of police history as an imperial tool for social control that continues to exacerbate class and racial tensions. Vitali also goes deep into the shortcomings of reform and, in contrast, deepens the conversations around meaningful alternatives to ultimately ask the reader to consider the end of policing. Upstream producer Robert Raymond spoke with Vitali at his home in Brooklyn, New York.
So there has been a growing awareness around the problems with policing in the United States in the last several years. Thanks in part to the work of Black Lives Matter and also because of things like cell phone cameras and videos. And so this awareness has sparked a debate about what to do about excessive police force and a lack of police accountability within the criminal justice system. Much of this debate focuses on various kinds of reform, but in your work, you actually argue against the idea that mere reform is enough. Your argument against reform includes a number of different yet related dimensions, including both a historical and structural analysis of policing. I'd like to focus on the dark historical origins of the police in the first half of our conversation, and then really dive into the structural analysis in the second half. So first, it might be helpful just for you to briefly provide an outline of your general thesis on why you think police reform is a dead end.
Sure. I think that we fail to understand the fundamental nature of policing when we suggest that things like body cameras and community policing and hiring a few additional Black police officers is somehow going to fundamentally change the mission and the scope of policing. We should be always mindful of the fact that of all the resources that the government, the state, has available to use to solve problems, the police are the most coercive and the most punitive, along with prisons, jails, courts, etc. And so those resources should always be used as a last resort. And so in every circumstance, we should be asking ourselves, are there solutions to our problems that can be solved without relying on that coercive state force? And what I attempt to show in the book is that a lot of what police do can be done in other ways without all the negative collateral consequences of arresting people, giving people tickets, issuing all kinds of fines, making threats, using force against people. And that when people come to see the police as the primary tool for solving their problems, they are failing to take into account the historical legacy of policing in actually reproducing inequality, especially for communities of color, but also for poor whites. And that it's this history that needs to be made more clear.
So maybe we can dive into the history a little bit. You talk about three different areas from which modern-day policing emerged. So there's sort of the colonial era, and then moves on into slavery and industrial capitalism, all with their own unique sort of forms of policing. I want to take some time to get into each of these threads separately, so maybe can you start telling us the story, beginning with the sort of darker origins of policing in the colonial era?
So first of all, I like to say that the problems with policing can be understood in kind of two ways. There is the part of the story that's hundreds of years old that has to do with the institutions of slavery, colonialism, and the suppression of the new industrial working class. And then there's a part of the story that's more recent that has to do with the war on drugs and the war on disorder and broken windows policing and the war on terror. So both of these elements are important in understanding why we should not be relying on the police as our primary tool for managing social problems. So often liberals will say, well, what's your big beef with the police? The police represented a professionalization of state social control mechanisms, shifting from informal watches, night watches, shifting from the use of militias to manage crowds to a professional civilian police force. But what they leave out of that historical understanding is the fact that the very origins of those first civilian liberal professional police forces was actually the colonial administration of Ireland by England. So the first modern police we often refer to as the London Metropolitan Police, formed in 1829, and they were created by Sir Robert Peel. But Sir Robert Peel didn't come up with the idea of civilian police out of thin air. In fact, he had been in charge of the British occupation of Ireland that perpetuated a system of agricultural and economic peonage for the Irish people. It was deeply exploitative. It led to famines, etc. And for many years, that occupation was managed primarily by military forces. But over the course of the late 18th and early 19th century, there were foreign wars and foreign colonial expansions that became very expensive, that utilized heavily the existing military forces. And Peel also noted that constantly using the military to put down various rural outrages, as they were called, basically rebellions, lacked legitimacy and often stimulated further resistance. So to counter that, the lack of resources and the need for a more legitimate form of social control, he creates the Irish Peace Preservation Force, which looks a little bit like the militia and a little bit like modern policing. And what was distinctive about it was that it was more civilian in character and it was embedded in local communities and often took on some role in dealing with crime, but almost all crime during this period should be understood as crimes of the poor against the rich. Poor people stealing things from the rich or engaged in low-level rebellions or more serious rebellions. And what the Peace Preservation Force did is it tried to use its position within the community to intimidate, to gather intelligence, to be preventative in its activities so that they didn't have to call out the militia or the military and open fire on people. In the U.S., we have our own direct colonial linkages to policing. The Texas Rangers, which were a highly lauded force in the American South and Southwest, many books written, many movies, etc., lionizing them. But they were basically created to facilitate the expropriation of land in Texas from first indigenous populations and then from the Spanish and Mexican populations. And they carried out basically mass extermination campaigns against the native peoples. And this then became a model for frontier justice across the rest of the much of the United States. Also, the first state police force, the Pennsylvania State Police, was designed to manage the growing number of industrial and mining strikes happening in Pennsylvania a little over 100 years ago. The model for that police force was the U.S. occupation of the Philippines, which had occurred as a result of the Spanish-American War. So there's a long legacy of developing policing as a political tool in the interests of colonial relationships.
And so we see the rise of these police forces during the colonial era. And around the same time, we have slavery in this country. What role did policing play during the era of slavery?
Well, I think, again, we can understand the origins of policing as tied in part to the institution of slavery. Now, not in all parts of the country, obviously, but what you have is these different things going on simultaneously in different geographic regions, and there's overlap. So slavery produces a certain form of policing in the American South. Now, people will sometimes refer to slave patrols and say, well, that's policing. Liberal police scholars will say, well, that's not professional modern policing. That's something else. Yes, it was despicable, but now we have something very different. What I show in the book is that actually in urban southern areas like Charleston, South Carolina, and Savannah, Georgia, and New Orleans, you get the formation of what looks very much like modern civilian policing well before the London Metropolitan Police. But the primary but not sole responsibility of those forces is the management of mobile slave populations. When we think about slave patrols, we usually think about rural areas and men on horseback riding down country roads looking for escaped slaves, which was a major part of the function of those patrols. But in urban areas, slavery took a very different form. In these urban areas, slaves generally worked outside of the place that their owner lived. They worked in wharves, in warehouses, in factories, for wages. Sometimes they even received some of the wages for their own use, but the bulk of it returned to the slave owner. But what these cities were confronted with was the fact that there were now a huge population of slaves moving around freely within the city, and sometimes in conjunction with legally freed slaves who had the right to own property and have small businesses. And this created a tremendous anxiety among the white population that slaves would form underground societies, reading groups, religious organizations, political groups, speakeasies, and all of this, in fact, was going on in places like Charleston and New Orleans. And what this new modern police force was doing in Charleston as early as 1789, we have the Charleston City Guard that's wearing uniforms, professional, carrying out these law enforcement duties, but what they're enforcing primarily are the micro-regulation of these mobile slave populations. And the Charleston City Guard, after slavery, then becomes the Charleston Police Department. There's a fairly seamless transition there, and this is true in other parts of the South where what had been slave patrols then morph into local policing.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Making Contact. You're listening to an interview with Alex Vitale, author of The End of Policing, brought to us by the Upstream Podcast. For more information on Vitale or the Upstream Podcast, visit our site at radioproject.org.
So looking at the history of policing in the United States, it's not hard to see why we're in the situation that we are in right now with the police and with the United States having the largest population, I think both absolute and per capita of
That's right.
incarcerated individuals in the world. So maybe you could discuss what happened in the last century to lead us to being such a hyper-incarcerated society and how we can see the historical legacy of policing being played out now in our modern society.
Yeah, there really was a dramatic transformation. So for much of the 20th century, incarceration rates in the United States look basically flat and look a lot like Europe and other industrialized areas. But in the 1970s, there begins an abrupt upswing that continues up until just recently, just the most sustained and dramatic increase in incarceration rates. And what I'm interested in particular is the role of police in that process. and the tools that empowered police and encouraged police to be part of that trajectory. And police are not the only players. We know from Jonathan Pfaff's work that the role of DAs is incredibly important in explaining mass incarceration, and of course the changing of sentencing regimes by lawmakers. But what we've seen is this dramatic expansion in both the scope and intensity of policing along a broad number of fronts. So we have the war on drugs. We have the expansion of the enforcement of various kinds of vice laws. We have the rise of the policing of homeless populations, mentally ill populations, basically the creation and then rapid expansion of school policing, gang suppression policing, border policing. So in all these areas, for both individual reasons and then for some overarching reasons, police have expanded the number of things they do, the powers they use, like the widespread creation of SWAT teams and other paramilitary forces. But all of this is tied to important political and economic transformations that begin in the 60s and 70s. And I think the best way to think about it is the interaction between neoliberal restructuring and neoconservative politics. So on the one hand, this is the period where we begin to see mass deindustrialization and a reshaping of the economy into a kind of post-industrial economy, where a fairly small number of workers who are directly tied to high finance, the management of multinational corporations and high-level business services for those sectors, those folks are making massive wages. They're enjoying huge tax cuts, deregulation. And at the same time, we have the replacement of an industrial, middle-class, unionized wage force with a service industry sector where wages are diminished, benefits are diminished, job security is diminished, so that people are unemployed, underemployed, sometimes overemployed, but at very low wages with no job security, so that people are taking two jobs, three jobs to try to make ends meet. And this, in turn, is producing high levels of disorder so that we have mass homelessness. I should say also what's also occurring is what we call, you know, government austerity, structural adjustment. So in order to provide subsidies, tax cuts, and incentives to high finance, multinational corporations, real estate industry, insurance, high-level business services, there's a hollowing out of social programs, of redistributive programs. The backlash against the welfare state that we see beginning in the Nixon administration. And then this is combined with an expansion of the social control functions of the state to manage this new disorderly and sometimes crime-prone communities. And so you get an expansion of criminal law. You get an increase in punitiveness within the system. You get an expansion of policing into more areas of everyday life. And none of this is really primarily about making us safer in some specific sense. It's more about managing these new dangerous classes, if you will.
So one thing that I wanted to get into, because it's just recently come back up, is the militarization of the police in the United States in particular. So the 1033 program, maybe if you could talk briefly about what that is and how it seems to be escalating under the Trump administration and how police can possibly justify needing grenade launchers and stuff like that.
So the militarization of policing has got a long arc. It goes back to the 1960s with the formation of SWAT teams, which were designed initially to deal largely with the political uprisings that were happening. and the threat of, you know, armed insurrection movements from the Black Liberation Army and groups like that. So it always was very political, and it rarely had anything to do. It was really about the fear of these things that were incredibly rare occurrences, especially over the last 30 years. So instead, we've seen this increasing mission creep of these SWAT units. Instead of reducing their numbers, they've exploded. Peter Kraska's work at Eastern Kentucky is very important in documenting this. The number has exploded, the intensity of their work has exploded, and the armaments that they use, the scope of law enforcement they engage in. So now you've got SWAT teams all across the country serving, you know, low-level drug warrants at 4 in the morning, bashing down doors, throwing in flashbang grenades because someone's suspected of having some pot in the house. This has led to deaths, the killing of pets, the injuries of small children, the killing of people who are completely innocent because the SWAT team's at the wrong address. And rather than challenging this, the Obama administration dramatically expanded it. The 1033 program allows for the direct transfer of military hardware from the Department of Defense to local police departments with almost no checks and balances. The Marshall Project recently created fake police departments and got millions of dollars of hardware sent to basically a PO box with no oversight, no monitoring, and they got all kinds of military hardware. They could have done whatever they wanted with it. In addition, even more money goes into Homeland Security terrorism grants to police departments, tens of billions of dollars for local police departments to buy military hardware from defense contractors. It's basically welfare for the defense industry. And all of this has contributed to an increasingly militarized mindset within policing that's being experienced as changes in training, changes in procedures, and the expansion and use of these paramilitary units. And all of this has contributed directly to the number of people being killed by police, the militarization of the policing of protests like we saw in Ferguson that was completely counterproductive.
More recently in St. Louis.
In St. Louis.
Where you had the police marching down the street in unison chanting, "Whose streets? Our streets."
Yes, exactly. And so this is a deeply problematic development. And Trump's changes are actually incredibly minimal. The Obama administration, after Ferguson, was pressured to restrict some of the kinds of military hardware. But basically, he said, you can't have bayonets. You can't have actual tanks with tracks on them. And you can't have camouflage uniforms anymore. That's it. You can still have grenade launchers. You can still have armored personnel carriers as long as they have wheels instead of tracks and mine-resistant vehicles and night vision scopes and ballistic hardware, you know, and high-grade ammunition. I think he also restricted anything that was 50 calibers or above was too big. But anything else is fine, AR-15s and this sort of thing. So the Trump changes are largely symbolic by reallowing this stuff, and many police departments have come out publicly and said, we don't want that stuff. Civilian policing shouldn't have that stuff. So it's more about a theater of empowering the police than any actual changes in policing. But we're certainly, it's a step backwards in calling into question the fundamental nature and direction of policing right now.
I'm just curious, the funding, the amount of funding that goes to the police, I know it probably varies widely between municipalities and states, but do we see the police departments being defunded? Is that happening?
Right. So just the opposite. The police department, there's always money for more police,
right?
I often say. I mean, there are exceptions here or there. There's always money for more prisons, if that's the political priority. And this transformation, you know, there's nothing particularly rational about it. It's not cost effective. It doesn't produce justice. It's about managing inequality. And so there is always a willingness to spend money on these social control mechanisms rather than social programs. And when you have an economic system that says that wealth and inequality is because some people are more qualified than others, not because of the failure of market forces, then the solution is forcing those who are on the losing end to behave themselves and accept their diminished position, kind of blaming the victim. And because if we were to admit that market forces had something to do with this rise of inequality, then we'd have to do something about those market forces. And the ideology of neoliberalism does not allow for that. So instead, we need an ideology of punitiveness that says that the cause of all our problems are moral failings and individual inadequacies, and the way to manage that is through punishment and threats to force people to alter their behavior and to get with the program, to accept their position in society. And that means that problems like even homelessness and profound mental illness are not treated as problems of inadequate housing or inadequate mental health care. They're treated as problems of public disorder and criminality.
If you were to go and look at the root causes of the problems in our society, and particularly with policing, what would you be looking at if you went upstream? And if you could just outline or how you would design or replace the criminal justice system, what you would have in place of that?
Well, I think let's go back to what I said before about community problem solving. We should have policy in place that says that communities should have more power to call on government to provide a full range of services to solve community problems, which they don't have now. What they have are the police. And so the community should be able to say, what we need is community-based mental health treatment and supportive affordable housing and real summer jobs for our young people and real after-school opportunities that don't just keep them busy but help develop them as full human beings, that we try to bring these young people into society instead of pushing them out, and we give them real resources to do that. You know, we have blocks here in Brooklyn where the state of New York spends $1 million a year to incarcerate people from one single block. And the question is whether or not the community could figure out a better way to spend that $1 million than locking people up to produce safety in that community. And I'm sure that they could. Now, maybe there are a couple of homicidal rapists that they don't want to deal with, that they need them to be locked up. But a lot of these people are in for things that we could resolve without relying on police and prisons. We just need the political will to do it. And so ultimately, to get to that position, politically, we have to break the back of this neoliberal mindset that the only appropriate role for government is to subsidize the rich and penalize the poor. And we need to find a politics that does that and embrace that at the local level and the national level. And at the center of that has to be an agenda of racial justice.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
And that's it for Making Contact. If you'd like to hear more about Alex Vitale's work or learn more about the Upstream podcast, please visit our site, radioproject.org. Special thanks to the co-producers Della Duncan and Robert Raymond of the Upstream podcast for allowing us to broadcast an abridged version of the conversation. Lisa Rudman is our executive director. Marie Che, Anita Johnson, Monica Lopez are our producers. Sabine Blazan is our audience engagement manager. And Vera Tykolsker is our development associate. And I'm RJ Lozada.
That's the sound of the police. That's the sound of the beast. That's the sound of the police. That's the sound of the beast. That's the sound of the police. That's the sound of the beast. Stand clear, done, man, attack. You can't stand where I stand, you can't walk where I walk.
or when my car's hooked up, you know you want to follow me. Your laws are minimal.
I'm Naomi Klein, and you are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Northwest String Summit, July 19th through 22nd at Horning's Hideout in North Plains, Oregon. The Northwest String Summit is celebrating its 17th year as a bluegrass, roots, and Americana music festival. Performers this year include three nights of the Yonder Mountain String Band and Green Sky Bluegrass. Other performers include Andy Hall, the Shook Twins, Horseshoes and Hand Grenades, The Deer, Carolyn Cotter, and many more. Again, that's the Northwest String Summit from July 19th through the 22nd at Horning's Hideout, 21277 Northwest Brunswick Canyon Road in North Plains, Oregon. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hello, KBOO members. Thank you for being a part of our amazing community. It takes all of us to manage this great community resource, and the role played by the KBOO Board of Directors is essential. Here is an opportunity for you to join the KBOO Board and become part of the team that is guiding our daily work and representing the interests and visions of all our members. Please consider applying to become a KBOO Board member if you want to help serve our community and put your gifts and talents to good use. There is a time commitment of about 15 hours a month for all board members, and you must be a KBOO member. To apply, go to kboo.fm and fill out an application, or stop by the station to pick up a paper copy. The deadline to apply is July 20th, 2018. We are looking for folks who love KBOO, who are committed to our community, and who want to carry forward KBOO's values of peace, justice, democracy, human rights, multiculturalism, environmentalism, freedom of expression, and social change. KBOO needs you. Apply today.